I think what we need to be very careful to do in the West is not dilute these indigenous practices, because A, they're incredibly powerful and beneficial, and they've been honed over hundreds or thousands of years. And to dilute them is not only a little bit lazy, but it's a very subtle form of colonialism as well. And that's a real shame, because it's basically saying, this is good, but we can make it better. And that isn't right. And I think
that's my word, subtle form of colonialism. Hello and welcome to another episode of For Soul's Sake with another wonderful guest. We are here to uncover spirituality. We're trying to denoise all the woo-woo behind spirituality and wellness. And I'm joined today by a wonderful guest that will hopefully help us to learn and grow and open up our horizons, open up our understanding of spirituality. Today, I'm joined by Eddie Elsie, who is a UK-based shamanic practitioner whose mission is to make authentic spirituality accessible for the modern world and providing people with the spiritual tools needed to regain balance that they may have lost from facing difficult mental health issues or physical conditions. Through suffering intensely with anxiety and OCD, it was shamanism that allowed Eddie to put himself back together again. 5 years ago, Eddie started Street Spirituality, an initiative to help bridge the gap between the ancient knowledge and contemporary life, whilst also paying forward all the valuable lessons he's learned from his shamanic teachers. Eddie now runs numerous group workshops, one-to-one healing sessions, and corporate offerings, all based around ancient shaman practices assimilated for today's world. His work has been featured in GQ, Men's Health, Women's Health, The Evening Standard, Tatler, The Telegraph, The Metro, and Stylist magazine, to name a few. His writings have also been featured in two leading articles for Europe's premier shamanic magazine, Sacred Hoop. Eddie is currently writing his first book, due out in January 2024. Eddie, thanks, mate. Appreciate you coming out and being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Radhika. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a great honor. And to be honest, I have not looked up what shamanism is. So this is going to be as much an educational trip for me than it is for the listener. Let's start there. What does the word shamanism... give me some context. Give me some understanding.
So at its core, in a traditional sense, shamanism is a spiritual practice that's based around possession. You know, a shaman would become possessed by a helping spirit, often an ancestral spirit, but perhaps a land spirit. And they would act as a conduit for this spirit's power to come through, to either heal or to find information on the more kind of different aspects, maybe to curse, maybe in times of war. It's essentially connecting to higher forces, but local higher forces, and helping with worldly issues. Shamanism is a practice that is predominantly from Central Asia, around Mongolia, Siberia, some other places, Korea, Nepal as well. It also exists in pockets in South America, Central America too, and also in North America. So it's found worldwide. It's an extension, if you like, of a practice called animism. Animism is this belief that everything is imbued with a spirit, or at least everything is alive in some sense and owned by a spirit. So you might have a mountain, for example, which doesn't have its own spirit, but the spirit that lives there will be the owner of that place.
Wow.
So it's a beautiful way of looking at the world. And I think it's gaining in popularity because people are, you know, once again, trying to tune their ear to the earth and really become connected to something, to be rooted to their land. Mm. It's a very local form of spirituality. And in the West, it's slightly different. In the West, it's a little bit more psychological. My training originally was in core shamanism, which is more psychological, helps more with some mental health issues, things like anxiety, depression, OCD, which is what led me to it. In a traditional sense, in my experience, it's less focused around that. It's more of a welcome byproduct. So there's a little bit of a difference between traditional shamanism and Western forms of shamanism. Mm. We're very mind heavy in the West.
I mean, it shows how little I know. I even said shamanism, didn't I? Shamanism. I pronounced it wrong at the beginning.
Yeah, I've heard both. Yeah. Yeah, shamanism.
I mean, just to dive in, you said something at the beginning that kind of took me a little bit back. You said something about a possessive spirit. Did that not scare you when you first kind of came across this? What attracted you to that as opposed to maybe more traditional? I don't know if it is, maybe it is traditional spirituality, but more traditional religious spirituality like Christianity or Islam or Hinduism, Buddhism, etc.
Yeah, it still scares me.
Really?
A little bit. It's I think what's important to add is it's not inviting any old spirit in. This spirit so often, you know, very specific.
Mm.
And there's a lot of trust that's formed between the practitioner and the spirits that they work with. So it's not just an open possession to, you know, inviting anything in to come in. I think possession also has a negative context in the West through films and different stories, and this idea that's really big in the West of losing control. And, you know, that builds into the fear as well. But it is a hardcore spiritual practice, which I think in the West also, you know, talk about Western forms of shamanism. Core shamanism was developed by this Westerner called Michael Hana, who went around the world and studied with different indigenous cultures and kind of repackaged different parts of shamanism and animistic practice for the Western mind. Mm. And so it is slightly different. In a traditional sense, it's a very hardcore, tough practice. My training has led me into a more traditional sense, but I'm very much at the early stages of that, which is very different. It's a lot, it was a lot scarier for me personally.
I can imagine. You're conversing with spirits, you're conversing with subtle beings, you're having conversations, or you're having more, you know, is it conversations on the level of the mind, or?
On the level of a certain aspect of the mind, I'd say the deeper aspect of the mind, not necessarily the thinking mind.
Mm.
But essentially, it's a very difficult thing as a Westerner to really understand. You know, although I've been doing this for nearly, you know, 7-8 years, I still feel, especially I went to Mongolia last year, and that was really my first real experience with traditional shamanism. Although I've worked with indigenous cultures before, you know, being, you know, really with the community out there, it was incredibly eye-opening. And, you know, one of those things where you kind of reach the end of a cycle and you're like, okay, now I've got a good understanding and I'm ready to, you know, move on. And then you get somewhere and then that's like, oh, actually, I don't really know anything at all.
Right.
That kind of illusion gets shattered. And so, you know, I'm at the end of one cycle and starting another one.
Yeah.
But to go back to your question, it's about possession without the possession aspect of it.
Right.
You know, it can't really be called shamanism. You know, it can be shamanically influenced, which I think a lot of, you know, wonderful work is in the West. And I don't think we'll necessarily get to the point where we have, you know, hardcore shamans in the West. I know
is
a
that
few
tradition
people,
is lost, do you reckon?
We're starting again. Mm. Starting again, which, you know, we had animistic practices here. We had the Celts. We had the Saxons at one point. Even the Romans, when they came, were pagan as well.
Mm.
The Norse traditions that came over.
And that can still be considered shamanism-ish.
Yeah. Shamanism, I think, is a more... more complex version of animism. So you've got your very complex practices like astrology, more complex rituals. It's kind of the natural evolution of animistic practice in certain places became shamanism.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know for sure whether we had shamanic practices here. There's elements of Norse, there's a Sæther tradition in Norse tradition which has elements of possession. Someone would sit in a high seat and channel the Norse deities, which could be considered shamanic.
Right.
But they were definitely animist and pagan as well. So we had these, you know, I call them these earth-centric cultures, and we had them here, definitely. But unfortunately, they're gone.
Yeah.
You know, the roots of them are gone. There's tiny little fragments that remain. And, you know, I've gone through a journey of really spending my time looking back and trying to uncover them in my own way and trying to, you know, breathe some life back into them. But the most powerful experience for me was to go to a pre-existing tradition and then, you know, have the opportunity to really start again from scratch and really humble myself and learn actually how they do things. And then with the view, you know, obviously with their permission, to really try and apply those methods to our lands. And wow. I think this is something that will take generations, you know, to really ground that again here.
Amazing. It says in your introduction that you suffered with anxiety and OCD and it was quite intense for you, and that shamanism has helped you to overcome, or is helping you to overcome. I don't know what word to use there. Do you want to kind of share that experience of, did you call in a spirit to help? Did you call in, I mean, do you want to just describe that a little bit more and maybe what the process is and how that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I still suffer from anxiety sometimes, OCD less now. You know, just to set the expectation that it's not this panacea of a practice that will solve all of your problems. But I think what shamanism really enabled me to do is put enough of myself back together where even my issues, they might have stayed the same, but I grew around them, I became bigger. And so they became something which I was able to integrate into my life. And you know, although I get anxious and recognize it, it's not something that's debilitating. You know, anymore, by, you know, in any way. So shamanism provided that for me. I think when I was growing up in North London, I never came from a spiritual background or a religious background. I was quite debaucherous, had a bit of a hedonistic streak in me, and I think that what I saw as religious or spiritual seemed quite confining. And when I found shamanism, it was like a big exhale. It's like, oh, this, wow. You know, all of me is welcome within this practice. And it enabled me the space to navigate myself and to really understand who I was within it, whilst also really connecting me to something which was big enough to hold me, which is the land, you know, and the local landscape. And, you know, for a guy from London to suddenly be shown different techniques and practices and experience ceremony and ritual, which is about coming back to the earth and the natural world and the real natural pace of life, was so moving and you know, life-changing for me. And that sort of became my passion, to show people that you don't need to be a certain way to be spiritual, or you don't need to come from a certain background, or you can live anywhere and connect to the earth. The earth is, you know, even in a city where I'm from, it's amazing. It's underneath the concrete, wow. You know, it's always holding us, and, you know, you can always, always contact it. And that's something.
Even now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you take us through a process or?
No, not in the sense of, you know, doing a ritual right here, but in terms of, you know, being grounded and connecting to the earth, you know, wherever you are in the world, that's possible. And growing up, that wasn't something I even thought about. You know, I never even considered that would be a possibility. It was my life just seemed very small in a bit of a box. And I think my mental health conditions really
sprouted from that.
And reflected that back at me, of this real tension of like, I'm not enough, or there's not enough here to hold me, and that fear that brought up.
Wow. Is it something that is a daily sadhana, like a daily practice for you that you have, which you, you know, you set time aside where you're contacting? I'm trying to find the right words. Maybe you can fill in the blanks for me. What is a daily practice for you look like?
My personal practice is a lot of meditation at the moment.
Okay.
To work with spirit, you need to have a real firm understanding of your own mind. That's something that at first I didn't have, and it was making things very ungrounded. And so as I've kind of evolved in my practice, I've really, this idea of like spiritual self-care has become much more of a priority for me. You know, making sure I'm balanced in myself and I can regulate my own emotions so that when I do work with spirit in some way, I'm able to know where I end and spirit begins.
Right. You know what's you and what's not.
Yeah. And that's something that I've had to develop, you know, not myself, but I've been pointed in that direction through my teachers, of something that would really benefit me.
Wow.
Because, you know, I think with all parts of spirituality, but especially forms of spirituality where the idea is to hand yourself over to something, it's easy to become ungrounded.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, just hearing, if I'm totally honest, I find it a little bit scary to hand myself over to something that's not me.
Yeah.
And in one sense, like, I can understand the concept because, you know, I come from a practice of bhakti yoga, which is to connect with divinity, with God, and to surrender one's own desires and to work in the will of God, so to say, and to be loving and to be guided by that loving influence. So I can understand that. But this, in once, and you have to correct me if I'm totally wrong, but it sounds a little bit darker. Is it?
I suppose there's a weight to it. The way I think about it, it's kind of like being plugged into the mains a little bit. And how you direct that energy is up to the person. And unfortunately, you know, it is a practice that gifts people a lot of power, which isn't the unfortunate part. The unfortunate part is how that power is then wielded. And you do hear lots of stories, especially in the West, of teachers, you know, abusing their power and getting caught up in it. And again, that, you know, going back to that idea of spiritual self-care and really understanding who you are and taking accountability for who you are. So when you are plugged into the mains and you have access to this power, that there's not a distortion in the way that it's used. Mm-hmm. So it carries a lot of responsibility, definitely. And you know, one of the things I try to, you know, share with people who want to experience shamanism is to really go slow and really be gentle, because it's powerful. You know, it's very powerful, like any spiritual practice at its core is. And to go too fast into something is very easy when it's like the dangling the carrot of healing, you know, and just,
right,
I'm going, you know,
this will solve your problems.
Right, exactly. You know, this will be my salvation. This is something which I need to do more and more and more of. And more is, you know, not always better. Often it's not. Yeah.
We live in a culture like that, right, where it's, here's the solution to your problems. And just, it's like the pill culture. You know, you take this pill, it'll solve your pain.
Yeah.
And sure, okay, I'll just take more pills then. More pills, more happy.
Exactly. You know, we were talking yesterday on the phone about, you know, this trend of psychedelics.
Yeah, and this is what I wanted to get into.
Yeah.
And does that fit into your, like, daily practice? Do you take substances to access these spirits or to, yeah?
No.
Shamanism, is that at all, none of it's linked with anything of substance like drugs or hallucinogenics or...
Well, this is, it's interesting because lots of people, when you think of shamanism, they think of plant medicine, you know, almost hand in hand.
Right.
To the point where if I run retreats or events, people all the time, I'll get a few messages saying, well, you know, at what point are we doing the ayahuasca or something?
Right.
And there's only certain shamanic cultures that use plants.
A small amount? A small percentage of?
Traditional. Yeah. It's a smaller amount. It tends to be focused in the Americas. Obviously, the Amazon rainforest is you know, the you know, I think it holds, like, I don't quote me on this, but a high percentage of the amount of, you know, plants in the world, you know, and it's like nature's pharmacy. Like, a lot of even the medical drugs formed from substances and plants from the Amazon, and you know, that's their natural way of doing it. And ayahuasca, you know, in that traditional indigenous setting, is, like, you know, mind-blowingly powerful and healing. You know, it's incredible. But most shamanism is getting into trance and going through that possession process through the drum or a jaw harp or dancing or chanting.
Wow.
Something repetitive. And don't use plants. There's pockets of cultures in Siberia that use the Amanita muscaria, and I don't know how prevalent that is anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in the West, shamanism and psychedelics often go hand in hand. I don't take any substances. I have your beer at football, but other than that, nothing. I haven't worked with plant medicine in the past.
Yeah,
and I found it in the traditional setting, even with people who've grown up with the plants.
Yeah.
And hold the traditional ceremonies, incredibly beneficial. And I've also experienced a non-indigenous setting and found it very destructive, personally. Which goes, again, going back to that power, you know, working with spirit. Same thing when you work with the plants. The spirits of these plants are incredibly powerful, and if that's not wielded in a correct way, again, it's like being plugged into the mains and
not knowing what's you and what's spirit.
Yeah, things can be very difficult. And in my one-to-one practice, I see, you know, regularly people who need to be kind of brought back and put back together. Wow. You know, people need different things. For some people, this idea of, you know, expanding into the transpersonal and coming out of the mundane and really being connected is really beneficial. But some people are so out there and connected that actually it's the opposite. They need to actually ground and get back to the everyday.
Wow. So you're, I mean, in your personal practice, you're not really into using anything that's outside of yourself, essentially.
Not personally.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I ascribe to the same thing. I'm very much of the, like, my practice involved chant, dance, and I'm sure you probably had a look of what kirtan is.
Yeah.
And so that's why I found it really interesting, and probably the reason why I thought it would be, this conversation would be quite interesting, was that you also, because a lot of shamanism is based around using substances like ayahuasca. In fact, believe this or not, after one kirtan on a Friday night, which we have at Om Nom, someone came up to me and gifted me something. And I asked, what is it? And they said, oh, just burn this in your home and it'll be very purifying. It'll purify the atmosphere. I was like, oh, it's incense. So no, it's herbal, organic. And I said, okay, what is it? And they just were evading the question because they almost knew that I wouldn't do it.
Mm.
And they said, no, just burn it in your home. It'll be very, very nice, very good for the atmosphere. And I had to hold them and say, excuse me, mate, do you mind just telling me exactly what it is?
Yeah.
And they told me it was ayahuasca. I said, how is this here in this country? And why are you giving this to me? I said, oh, because you're a spiritualist, right? Mm. And spiritualism means that you're going to take substances of some sort.
Yeah.
And I was like, I think that maybe we're on the wrong tangent, because I'm of the belief that there has to be some hard work that goes in and a traditional discipline of some sort.
Mm.
And I mean, where does that sit for you? Do you also ascribe to that?
Yeah, I think you can see spiritual growth as a graph, if you like. You've got the transpersonal and then you've got the mundane, and to grow you should have a balance of, you know, everything, which is where that spiritual discipline comes in. Getting up in the morning and doing a practice when you don't want to and you don't necessarily feel anything from the practice and you're not connecting and you're not experiencing this ecstasy and these life-changing visions, it's just practice. That is what roots you to the ground and roots you to the practice. And then every now and then, you know, you'll have these breakthroughs and these reminders, which, you know, don't happen all the time. And if they happened all the time, then it would take you too far up. And I think, you know, the new age Western forms of spirituality have been very good in, like, just being like, here it is, you do whatever you want.
Right.
You know, this is spirituality.
And, no rules.
You know, it can be this, there's nothing, it's limitless.
Yeah.
Which, you know, at first can be very healing for people, but
it can be very attractive.
Very, you know, but it's like a moth to a flame, and people get burnt up because it's like, no, we can do this and this and this and this. And in traditional settings, it's not that one is better and one is worse. It's just about, you need some limits. You need some, you need a container in which to, you know, move forward in. There's many, many paths to the same destination, but you'll never get there if you go on one for 2 minutes and then another for 10 minutes. And, you know, you don't end up going around in circles. And that's what I find with the new age. You've got these things which have never been together in a traditional setting, like shamanic Reiki or cacao ceremony.
Cacao and like kirtan has become
kirtan, a thing. Right? And it's like, well, this is a nice idea.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you mean well, but it, you know, I think what we need to be very careful to do in the West is not dilute these indigenous practices, because A, they're incredibly powerful and beneficial, and they've been honed over hundreds or thousands of years. And to dilute them is not only a little bit lazy, but it's a very subtle form of colonialism as well. And that's a real shame, because it's basically saying, this is good, but we can make it better. And that isn't right. And I think
that's mind-blowing. You know, subtle form of colonialism. Yeah, I've never thought about it like that, but it makes so much sense that this is what it is, but we can make it better.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a conscious decision where people are saying, you know, I'm going to take this and I'm going to improve it. It's just about saying, this is, you know, I'm adding my flair to it. You know, people are just emerging and flourishing and saying, oh, this would be great. You know, I'd love some cacao before I do kirtan, you know, we wouldn't.
Yeah.
But we have to stick to these practices. We have to master these practices as they are before we can ever contemplate changing and shifting them to, you know, to suit our culture. And I think to some people that could maybe seem a bit boring. And I think that's an important place to look, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we live in a culture which wants enlightenment now on the fingertips, you know. Give it to me on the screen. Give it to me in 10 minutes. Give it to me in half an hour, maximum 2 hours. Give it to me in such a way where I can go home and I don't have to do any work for it.
Yeah.
You know, and although I think there is a place where we have to make things relevant and we have to try and make things accessible, you know, just by speaking the language of English, you know, we're having to translate, we're having to try and make things more relevant for people and accessible, all those kinds of buzzwords. But there is definitely a tragedy in losing the tradition. And what can we do? I guess we have to try and limit that as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst at the same time, personally, I think we have to then practice our traditions with authenticity. And, mm-hmm. and it's not going to attract everyone. It's not going to be the most popular thing. But sometimes not being popular isn't always a bad thing, you know?
No, not at all. And I think, you know, I think you don't have to sacrifice authenticity to make something accessible. And that's something I'm very passionate about.
Wow.
You know, really trying to navigate both of those things and saying, look, here I am. I'm just a normal guy from London who, you know, I'm no different to anyone else who maybe feels that shamanism doesn't apply to them.
Mm.
Yet I don't want to water down shamanism to get people on board. I want to instead, you know, show people that they can get on board with, they can be whoever they are and also experience authentic practice. And I think the lack of authenticity is what turns a lot of people off.
Right.
Because, you know, shamanism and not just shamanism, but any traditional form of spirituality is actually very practical. And it's very grounded. And there's a real, you know, logic to it. And when you experience a traditional form of spirituality, it's they don't make these wild claims that you hear a lot in the New Age. Everything is based around certain practice with the expectation that if I teach you a practice and you do this in the way that I tell you every day for the next 6 years, if you do 100,000 repetitions of this mantra, or if you continue to, you know, practice in the way that I tell you, this idea of like following your teacher to the T, you'll get there. You know, it's not about having the gift or being the chosen one. It's just about hard work and discipline. It's more like a martial art, to be honest. You know, if you keep going, you'll become a black belt. But you have to keep going. You know, you're not going to walk in here, the special one, and we're not just going to give you a black belt.
Yeah. There's this thing in the Bhakti text that talks about how anything that's worth doing is usually poison in the beginning and nectar in the end.
Wow.
And anything that's not worth doing is usually nectar in the beginning and poison in the end.
Wow.
You know?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a much more poetic way of saying it.
Yeah. You know, people think that, oh yeah, if I get it, if you know, people are attracted to kirtan, if I'm honest, a lot of the time, because it's going to be euphoric and ecstatic. And yes, that's definitely there.
Mm.
But the layers that are deeper that can be accessed, if one has a sadhana, a daily practice, which involves chanting and involves, you know, the devotional services that are involved, that's way more powerful. Like the kirtans that I experience now than when I first started the practice, what, 15 years ago, are completely like miles apart. Before, like, I just used to like watching everyone dance and checking out the girls in the kirtan, and you know, that was my experience. I was like, yeah, this is cool, sober rave.
Mm.
But yeah, the access point to God, to divinity, to my spiritual reality, to understand that I'm the soul seated within the heart, that's not a cheap practice. And here's an interesting question. One of the things that comes up in Bhakti Yoga is about how we should hold that which is like spiritually real for us. We should hold that a little bit private. Mm. Like we shouldn't like go out and promote, I have become more self-realized, you know, I shouldn't shout out about it because it cheapens that, you know, that deep inner realization. Is there something similar in shamanism? Is that a thing? Or you?
Yeah, there's a lot of secrecy.
Right.
In the local traditions as well. And there's...
Are you doing that with me today?
Well, there's things I like, the specifics of practice, I'm not allowed to share. You know, I'm you know, learning from a lineage now, and it's very different. Core shamanism is slightly, it's much more loose. Core shamanism.
Core, like C-O-R-E.
Yeah.
Core
yeah.
shamanism. Okay.
And yeah, when I experienced a traditional lineage from, I suppose from the inside, but not just from the sense where, you know, I was given some teachings.
In South America?
In Mongolia.
Mongolia.
And a prerequisite of having the teachings is you can't share this.
Wow.
Because, again, goes back to that point of, until you've mastered the teaching, you will have no option if you share it to dilute it.
Mm.
And if you dilute this teaching that we have sacrificed lives to protect, then, you know, what does that mean for your karma?
Mm.
You know, and that's something which, you know, I'm very passionate about, and you know, conscious goes back to that subtle form of colonization, you know, coming back here. And you know, over the last year, I've sacrificed a lot in terms of, you know, trying to do things the right way. Like I said, in course shamanism, there's not necessarily the rules. It's like, okay, if you want to do a retreat, do a retreat. If you want to do this, do this. And,
yeah.
You know, we've all got to make money, and, you know, don't go the extra mile with it and try and rip people off. But, you know, if you want to have it as a business, one of the first things Mongolian told me was get another job if you want to do this. You know, this isn't a job.
This is,
you know, you're there to help your community.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I came home and I stopped doing it as a job, and I got a job in the pub, you know, just to pay my mortgage. Like, okay, all right, this is where, you know, Eddie, you talk about authenticity. This is where you're going to have to do it.
Mean what you say and say what you mean.
And it was like a big thing, you know, my life has changed massively. I am, you know, internally, I'm much, much more balanced, you know, I'm much happier. But externally, it's been like, right, how do I make my life work now? You know, I built this identity around sharing shamanic practice.
Yeah.
And now I'm not allowed to share shamanic practice.
Yeah, right.
So it's this real like, okay, but that for me was like, right, okay, this is, you know, you've got to walk the talk now.
How sacred is it for you, really, isn't it?
And it's like, right, okay, I need to show that I mean business and show the respect. And so, you know, it's something I've had to really commit to. Mm. And it's been great.
Mm.
You know, really been life changing. And going back to your point about like keeping that, like your own inner sacredness, I think you said private. And that's something which I've realized is there for, there's a real purpose to that, to stop giving it away. It's like I said, you're like kind of dangling the carrot a little bit of like, this is what shamanism has brought me, and you can have this as well if you only do this.
For $9.99.
Yeah, right. And it's hard not to, you know, I'm Western, born with a capitalist mindset. That's what but very quickly was imprinted onto me. And it's hard to step out of that. You know, these are indigenous practices, and the indigenous mindset is different to a Londoner.
Mm.
But it's our duty, or my duty in this sense, to do whatever's necessary to be able to make it authentic.
Yeah, karmically, you've been given this opportunity to, you've you know, found authentic teachers, it seems, and you found a path which you connect with. And yeah, it's clear that we all have to, within reason, we have to follow that which has been, in one sense, a little bit predestined for us. Yes, we've got choices. You know, karma doesn't, according to the bhakti tradition, doesn't talk about everything being predestined, but that there are points, for example, the body in which you're born with, the parents, you can't choose your parents.
Mm.
You know, there are certain doors which open in your lifetime that you have no real choice over. They somehow have opened. And so we have to somehow walk without fear, and we have to somehow walk in the knowledge that, going all the way should not be feared, because the truth anyway lies beyond it.
Mm.
You know? And yeah, it's interesting what we're talking about, because, you know, something that one of my mentors told me, His Holiness Kadambakananaswamy, he told me that for every 1 hour I'm in front of a microphone, I should spend 2 hours behind it practicing authentically.
Wow.
You know, that it shouldn't just be that I'm trying to present for name and fame, but rather that it should be that I become a custodian of faith, someone that holds faith within the heart. And then whatever the overspill is, that just comes out naturally.
Wow.
And so, I'm speaking lofty words, and I don't know if I'll ever reach that standard. In fact, I haven't reached that standard today. I haven't practiced for 2 hours, and I'm still in front of a microphone. I'm trying, and I know I'm failing. I know I'm not the best at my practice, but I know what the standard is.
Mm.
And I don't want to ever water that down. You know, for someone else that is looking for a deep spiritual practice, I don't want to say, yeah, here's, just pay me $9.99, or, you know, pay me a grand, come on a retreat, and you'll have everything by the end of the retreat.
Mm.
Usually it's you come away with more work than you anticipated.
Yeah.
You know?
Wow. That's an amazing lesson.
Yeah.
Really amazing. I think that really sums up, you know, that segment, what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
There's a lot of glamour within spirituality in the West.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I think that's part of the attraction to it. It's like healers have almost become the new celebrities in a weird way, and I think there's this attraction of whether that's spiritual power or knowledge or wisdom or something, and it's, you know, unfounded, I think, because there's so much sacrifice that goes into it, and I'm not talking about me, or, but you know, you've got these people like Russell Brand, or you know, these gurus that people, you know, drop everything for and go and be like, you know, I want to be like you. And it becomes too personal, I think, and they miss actually the real true wisdom of it, which isn't something that's personal, individualistic. You know, it's not about becoming, you know, that person. It's about kind of finding who you are within that practice. And like you said, you are custodians of that practice.
Mm.
And that's a very hard, it's a very difficult discipline to hold. Especially when you're forward facing and you're in front of a microphone and you're trying to do your best to share,
to serve,
you know, and to serve it, and then everything that comes with it. You know, sometimes, you know, I guess the reason I got invited on today is mostly from my Instagram account. You know, I started writing stuff and people started following and liking and sharing, and I have loads of days where I'm like, I wish I never started this.
Wow.
You know, I wish I never, you know, and I was writing my book. And that's where I got book deal, because I had a certain amount of followers, you know, not loads, but enough to, for this book, you know, deal to be like, okay, you can write a book. And I was like, you've really got yourself in a mess here, Eddie. Like, you know, now you got all it, and it's like, everything becomes pressure, and it's like, God's like, what?
Everyone judges you by the words you use post having a voice, you know, like, prior to having any Instagram followers, you can say what you want when you want.
Yeah.
Now, every word, you can say 100 good things, but they'll judge you for the one thing that you say that's a bit dodgy.
It is, and growth is like this ever-expanding and contracting thing, and content is static.
Static.
And that is a really difficult juxtaposition to hold, because, you know, what I say here will be eternally wherever it is, and people say, oh, that's his opinion. And actually, I'm a different person to who I was last year.
Yeah.
You know, when I first started writing my book, I went back and read the first chapter and I was like, this is terrible.
Yeah.
I'm going to write it again. And I'm like, what point does that end?
Right.
You know, because it will just has to be locked in there. It's like, this is Eddie, this is where he stands, this is his opinion. I found that really, really difficult.
It's hard.
I heard this thing that, you know, in some indigenous cultures, they don't like people taking photos of them. And I was like, oh, I get it. And it seems like a similar thing. It's like you're freezing time.
Mm.
And it should never be frozen.
Yeah, I make it very clear, like a disclaimer quite often, that who knows whether I'll still be part of this practice 10 years from now.
Yeah.
Who knows? But what I can do is with, as the wise Gandalf says, you know, you do with the time that's been given to you as responsibly as you can. You know, you just try to make the best of the situation that you've got right now. Do I feel connected? Yes. Do I help others to feel connected? Yes. Should I continue? Yes. Do I have troubles and struggles like everybody else? Yes. You know, that is, they're not mutually exclusive.
No.
None of these are mutually exclusive. It's, tomorrow I may not be inspired to share. Should I continue to share anyway? Maybe. You know, none of them, we should see that, you know, that each person is having a fluid experience of spirituality, and none of them are concreted in stone.
Yeah.
Only if I've been doing it for 50 years, then I can say, yeah, look, 50 years is a good number. And actually, that's been quoted by my grandfather, Guru. He said that, yeah, once you've been performing devotional service for 50 years, can you say, yeah, you've made some sort of progress?
Wow. Yeah.
So I've got years to go.
That is the time scale
yeah.
that we're working with. And it's very humbling, but also
it's humbling, yeah.
there's a like a security to that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I don't need to have it all figured out right now. And I think, you know, it comes back to that authenticity about not trying to play a role because the role can be confining, can be static. And the more that you shift and change underneath that role, the harder it is to keep it up. And then you get this, like, you know, real tension that forms. And you just have to evolve
constantly
and keep sharing that stage of evolution. And people will come and go. And that's, I suppose, a normal process.
Mm-hmm. What motivates you then? Because, like, from when I first started seeing, like, what you were writing, and I was really attracted to it, because especially when what you talked about substances, I was like, here's a spiritualist that I can really feel a connection with because of what you spoke about with. And anyone that's interested, you can just go onto Eddie's Instagram page and find, I think you put, like, a nice picture of someone with a mushroom or something. I can't remember exactly what the picture was, but very, very nicely written. Caption that really kind of attracted me to what you're doing. And then I started thinking, you know, I wonder what motivates him, because is it a case that you want to be a deeply spiritual person yourself? Is it that you want to heal other people in the future? Is that a desire of yours? Is that something that you see yourself doing? Like, without sounding rude, is it you want to be a guru one day? Do you want to be a teacher of shamanism?
I think my main passion that all my little sub-passions orbit around is to give people permission to believe that shamanism is an option for them when it comes to healing, when it comes to a way of understanding and viewing the world, that it's something that could really benefit them. And if they choose themselves to explore that, then they can. You know, I remember when I started on my path and I was doing this kind of weird practice in the woods every now and then, and my mates
were
like, no, it's just part of my, you know, training, you know, not a specific practice, but, you know, going and leaving my kind of world and going into, you know, the woods for 4 days and doing different initiations and things. And
alone?
No, with a group. I mean, that's with the core shamanism, you know. So, you know, but like on our training, you know, we do long, long fire ceremonies, you know, drumming for hours and hours, spending time out in nature alone, fasting. We got buried alive, you know, things to really, they sound, I mean, I guess they are kind of odd, but they sound like the buried alive one. That was my favorite one.
Really?
It was actually very,
you felt connected
to, you know, sleep in the earth. But yeah, my friends are like, I can see how it benefits you, but I could never do that. I don't want to become a hippie. I don't want to do this. And it's
right,
like
the H word. Here we go.
Yeah, right. And I'm just like, okay, like fair enough. But why do you think that you have to? You know, and there's this taboo around spiritual practice that I hopefully will do my small part in removing. You know, and I also through the practice, yeah, I would love to help people and heal people, and my one-to-one practice is incredibly rewarding. I would like to be someone who bridges that gap between this authentic knowledge and then shares that in an authentic way, but something that's digestible for the Western mind, whether that's through language or image or just gives people that reference point, you know, an access point. You know, I don't for 1 second think I'm going to be a, you know, super, super powerful healer or, you know, some guru type. But if people can use me as a gateway to finding those people and to going on their own path and maybe becoming those people, then I'm more than happy with that. Wow.
Beautiful service.
Beautiful. Yeah.
This conversation has been really grounding. Like a lot of conversations, you get different types. Like some are really passionate, and some. This has been a very grounding conversation. I found it very, very peaceful.
Oh, good.
Thank you, man.
You're welcome.
Should we do some quick fire?
Go on.
I wonder how this is going to work. You're such a peaceful person. I wonder how we're going to do quickfire.
Okay, I'll try and amp it up.
No. No need. Be yourself. Everyone else is already taken. Okay, quickfire.
Yep.
One word, one sentence. And if it is something that you want to add something more, then I'm not into being so boxed in. So mm-hmm. Feel free. Number one, what's something that you're curious about right now?
Meditation. I'm loving meditation. Funny enough, I never meditated until I went to Mongolia. It wasn't something that was, this is going to be a lot more than one word, but
that's fine.
It wasn't something that that was seen as particularly important within my Germanic training. It was like, you know, there's other ways to reach that point. And, mm-hmm. you know, we drum and we're active and we're around fires and stuff. And I was like, yeah, okay, that's my way. And every time I sat down and meditated, it was too much. And, you know, when you read about shamanism, even traditional shamanism, there's not much in it around meditation. I was chatting to my Mongolian teacher about it, you know, and it's like lots of these traditional shamanic practice from nomads, and they don't really need to sit and meditate for hours because their life is a meditation. They're out with the animals in the elements. But for someone from London whose life is not a meditation, you should make time for it.
Right.
And I was like, oh, okay. So I meditated every day. I meditated every day for half an hour at least since then. It's been about 7 or 8 months now.
Going good.
And I can't be without it now.
Wow.
I love it. I just want to sit and be with myself. And that's something which...
Do you want to do a meditation with us here? Is it something you can share with
us? I can't share the meditation.
Ah.
I can't share the meditation. But maybe one day I'd love to.
Yeah.
But it's something that I, you know... Yeah, really, really cherish now. And that it's really changed my life.
Wow.
Really changed my life to find my
true
peace. And it's really allowed the shamanic practice, which is very kind of expansive and inviting different energies in and very ecstatic, you know, the trance and the possession state to be grounded in something that is eternal.
Wow.
And that's, real benefit. So... meditation.
I'm really happy for you, man. Amazing. Number two, what's something you're personally working through at the moment?
It's linked to the meditation, just like this feeling of searching, going, seeking, being on my phone, reading a book, moving, always, you know, talking and instead of just the introspectiveness and, you know, really uncovering what was hiding that. And for me, lots of feelings of overwhelm, you know, fear of overwhelm, too much energy and I think originally shamanism gave me a way to dispel that. It's like, well, I'm gonna go drum, dance, and like, you know, it's very ecstatic, but also to be able to learn how to do that without having to do that and just sitting.
Wow.
Really and just working through it. So that, you know, something I'm working through now is that sense of fear of being overwhelmed by life, I suppose, and things get too much, and really understanding who I am within that.
Number three, something you used to deeply value in your life, but don't value as much anymore.
Social media presence. Yeah, social media presence. I used to like check my followers, check my analytics, check my thing. But like, bear in mind, my page isn't a business page. It's just me.
Right.
Just talking. And I had so much identity wound up in it. And I just don't really care anymore. I don't have the same fire. So I suppose I don't value it as much. I value it. I'm very grateful and proud of my little like corner of Instagram where I can share shamanism things. Mm. But I have no desire really to, you know, become some Instagram like.
I'd probably say the exact same thing in that I also don't value it anymore. Like, I've noticed that I used to think that the higher the number, the more reach I've got to bring people to my practice.
Yeah.
But I've noticed that with what I've got already, it's actually doing perfectly the job as it is right now. And people who are attracted will come anyway.
Yeah.
Like, no need to, you know, cheapen what I do. No need to, you know, make it, more relatable just to get followers that ultimately will never actually practice in the first place anyway. So, yeah, I also feel exactly the same way. I don't at all care about the numbers anymore.
Yeah,
it's just super liberating. Anyone that's watching this and wants to try this, just post what's deeply on your heart and that you want to actually share, not just for the purpose of the numbers, because you genuinely like it, the content. And the people that like you will find you. Yeah. You know? Anyway,
that's it.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, pleasure.
Number four. If you could create one law, and this is the last one, by the way, if you could create one law that everyone had to follow, what would it be?
I would like, I suppose this is a little bit, what's the word?
Esoteric?
No, you know, when you like force people to, like a dictatorship, like a shamanic dictatorship, I would like there to be shrines and like offering places and like protection for all of our natural water sources. Wow. Need to be protected. Take into account the spiritual purity of nature, and for that to be like littering and destroying like natural habitat would be like a bad thing, like a really bad thing for people to do.
I'll vote for you in that dictatorship, like, man.
And other than that, you can do whatever you want, but that would be my I would like there to be rules around that, because I think it's a real shame that obviously we're destroying, you know, the habitat, but in terms of seeing these places as alive, I think it's really upsets me.
Mm.
That it, you know, you wouldn't go into someone's house and trash it, and I think that's exactly what we're doing, and it's to our detriment.
Mm. Thank you. That's a really nice law. Probably the nicest one we've had.
Really?
Wouldn't you say? Nice, no?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hold shrines in natural habitats.
It would be a law, though.
It would be a
That's
law.
That's it. So, yeah. No choice.
Yeah.
That's what makes it a bit weird.
Yeah, I guess so. But, we should petition for that. I think we should do it.
Mm.
Eddie, thank you so much for being part of this conversation. Thanks for demystifying shamanism to an extent, but also leaving some mystery there.
Yeah.
I don't know what to expect, if I'm honest with this conversation, because I've never had anyone from a shamanic tradition come on before, and this has been super interesting for me. If I'm hand on heart honest, it's super interesting. And it almost makes me want to Google it more. Like, I'm just like, oh, maybe there's something here that I need to find out about. But thanks for keeping it relevant and accessible. Thanks for keeping it still authentic to the mystery that lies beyond. And I hope you've enjoyed the conversation as much as I've had being here with Eddie. And if you want to check out all of his stuff, then you know where to go. If you want to hear this conversation again, repeat it. All you have to do is press play again and, you know, re-listen to it. I'm sure there's some value there for each and every one of you. And looking forward to seeing you on another episode of For Soul's Sake. See you soon. Namaste.
Thank you. For Soul's Sake.